Lecture 15, Etruscan Warriors and Warfare.
In the ancient world, Etruscan warriors were probably no better nor worse than those they faced among the Gauls, Greek city-states, and Rome. And they might have had greater motivation to fight than did many of their opponents. So we must seek another cause for what became a centuries-long streak of military losses. I will argue that the military failures of the Etruscans rest with poor centralized command and with a flawed or non-existent grand strategy. War was endemic in Etruscan society. Independent city-states waged small-scale war on their neighbors annually to capture cattle, slaves, and loot. A 6th century BC sarcophagus, or stone coffin, from Perugia shows a line of captives tied together with a rope around their necks, carrying loot home for the victors. The Brontoscopic calendar, a guide to divination, first created in the 8th century BC and written down about 680 BC, contains predictions of about 4 wars a month. The same calendar makes only 4 predictions of peace during the course of the entire year. It also makes a distinction between war, that is, among communities, and civil war within a community. Although war was a common event, casualties were generally low. Armies would fight until one side broke and ran. Only in the most extreme circumstances did they fight to the last man. Indeed, out of the 40 predictions of war that the Brontoscopic calendar makes in a year, only 1 prediction is for a particularly bloody war. Much of the responsibility for that low mortality rate is due to the armor worn by Etruscan soldiers. So let's survey the arms and armor of the Etruscan infantry, the backbone of its army, and then its cavalry, before analyzing who the soldiers were and how they were organized. Well, prior to the 5th century BC, bronze was the primary material for both armor and weapons. Not surprising, given the extensive copper mines and bronze industry then prevalent. The primary weapons were the flanged axe, a broad axe that could be wielded two-handed, and a single-edge sword. The sword was long and heavy, with a single sharp edge on the front side and a thick, blunt back, originally bronze, but eventually of a sophisticated forged iron. The upper third of the blade was often broader than the lower part near the grip. These swords could be compared to a machete or the kukri knife used by the Gurkha. It was a fearsome cutting weapon, and with the weight of the upper blade could do tremendous damage, rather like a meat cleaver, 24 to 32 inches in length. The 8th century BC burial of a warrior excavated at Tarquinia offers some evidence of the efficacy of traditional Etruscan weapons. His skeleton reveals that he suffered a number of sword wounds just prior to death. The killing blow came from a flanged axe that shattered his skull. It's very likely that he was first wounded in battle, captured alive, and then sacrificed in public. The only missile-like weapons were light javelins, which were thrown prior to engaging the enemy in hand-to-hand combat. The Etruscans also typically carried shields. The great variety of shield sizes and shapes reflect regional variations in Etruscan culture, as well as the individual nature of arming. Very different from the Greek hoplite, for example. A bronze vessel from about 600 BC, decorated with scenes of warfare, shows warriors with round shields, while another bronze vessel of about 500 BC is decorated with images of infantry with oval shields of at least 2 shapes and sizes. A third vessel of about 400 BC shows soldiers armed with both rectangular and round shields. Almost all such shields were bronze, or at least wood covered in bronze, and that was a type of skilled work that the Etruscans were very experienced in. The Roman poet Ovid tells us that the second king of Rome, Numa Pompilius, turned to the Etruscan, Mamurius Veturius, to make the 11 sacred shields carried by the priests of Mars. Well, along with the shield, a bronze helmet, greaves, and breastplate outfitted the well-equipped Etruscan warrior. Many breastplates of a wide variety of types have been found. Early examples, primarily from the 7th and 6th centuries BC, consisted of three bronze discs, two of them arranged over the chest and one over the stomach. Each of these bronze discs was supported and connected by leather bands or by a linen garment. In later examples, they'd be joined into a single piece of armor. In the 5th century BC, these were supplanted by the cuirass, the muscular two-piece breast and back. This solid body armor covered its occupant, from the collarbones to the hips, with idealized pecs, abs, and all those back muscles whose names I confuse, portrayed on the front and back. The earliest example of this type of armor found anywhere dates to 475 BC, and it was made in the Etruscan city of Vulci. A final refinement was the development of linen armor. Either lamellar, that is small overlapping bronze plates sewn on a linen garment, or layers of linen soaked in glue, making them stiff and sword resistant. Each of these variants was lighter, cheaper, and more flexible than the muscled cuirass. Among the finest Etruscan bronze statues to survive from antiquity is a large-scale, hollow-cast bronze votive from an Etruscan sanctuary. Called the Mars of Todi, but it's not a god, but an ideal image of a warrior about 400 BC. It represents a warrior wearing linen armor and a now-missing helmet. Portrayed in the act of pouring a libation from a cup held in his extended right hand. In his left, he holds a spear that he leans on. The dedication states that his name was Ahal Tritetus. It's a beautiful, detailed image of this form of body armor. It's now in the Vatican Museum, so check it out if you can. Finally, the Etruscans typically wore bronze helmets, the most common of which, I'm sorry to say, looks like an overturned bucket. The characteristic shape is referred to as a Nagao helmet type, from a cache of 26 helmets dating from 450 to 350 BC, found near Nagao, Slovenia. Now, this survey is important for the larger issue of how the Etruscans fought. It's clear to me that they never adopted the Greek hoplite armor or tactics, and, as I'll argue in a minute, that's critical to their military history. The main weapons of Etruscan hand-to-hand combat were cut rather than thrust weapons. This means that a warrior had to close to within just a few feet of the enemy to engage and fight in an open formation, since generating force meant swinging weapons in large arcs. A force armed like this couldn't fight in close ranks, so each warrior in battle was essentially fighting a series of single combats. For the sake of honor and reputation, there was also incentive to fight that single combat in front of the entire army prior to any larger engagement. The Greek historian Dionysius of Halicarnassus describes such a single combat that's worth relating. Both warriors carried along with equal courage, making no calculation for what would happen other than what they wanted to do. Spurring on their horses from opposite sides, explosively crashing into each other, both inflicting on each other with their lances inescapable death blows through their shields and breastplates, each drenching his spear in the opposite side of the other's ribcage. Their horses, entangled breast to breast, are thrown back on their hind legs by the force of the charge and rearing up, having thrown their riders. The fallen riders lay stretched out, bleeding out great quantities of blood from their wounds as they die. Well, the Etruscan cavalry was armed and armored identically to the infantry, with the possible exception of that muscle cuirass, which seems to have been adapted slightly to avoid restricting riders' movement. Finally, many examples of chariots have been found in Etruscan tombs and illustrated in their art, leading to the question of whether, inspired by Egyptian or Near Eastern examples, they rode them into battle. I'd say no. There's no evidence for that. They're used only as symbols of aristocratic status. So how did soldiers work in a unit? How was the army organized? And what were its command structures? At one stage, from the 8th into the 6th centuries BC, army units were based on social or familial factors. Most of them were organized by clans, so they're essentially feudal levies, fighting at the orders and in support of an aristocrat who was the head of that clan. This is significant because it means that the military served to reinforce the power structure of the aristocracy. Also, since aristocratic reputation was based, at least in part, on military success, defined by personal achievement, the result is a number of units with strong motivations to act independently and to look for opportunities to engage the enemy and acquire loot. The effect on larger strategy, however, could be disastrous. A decision to declare war in the period prior to 500 BC was based on the actions and aspirations of powerful aristocratic men with personal interests in warfare. Tactics that might prevail without actual battle, such as a long-term siege or burning crops to deny food supplies to foreign troops, were often anathema to the military commanders and their men. Specifically, as soldiers were not paid, they typically were eager to seize loot for themselves. As a result, the Etruscan units were not the well-trained Greek hoplites of the Persian Wars. Instead, we should picture a loose formation without the mutual support and disciplined maneuvers of the Greek and later Roman armies. No doubt the warriors were fierce individuals, each determined and aggressive in his own right. But operating with a tremendous amount of autonomy, they would have been at a constant disadvantage against Greek and Roman foes who fought en masse. Now, some scholars see the Etruscan adoption of the full Greek panoply, that is, helmet, breastplate, greaves, and shield, as evidence of political changes in the Etruscan state. Regarding the Greeks, the argument is that hoplite warfare was connected to democracy and worked at its best with large numbers of men risking their lives to protect the state rather than their own narrow self-interest, such as the glory sought by Greek heroes. With one exception, the Etruscan city-states never developed the extensive radical democracy of Athens in the 5th century BC. And their rigid social hierarchy would be a major stumbling block to the egalitarian hoplite model. Even after the shift away from aristocratic rule to tyranny or representative government, the military in almost all city-states consisted of units organized by extended family, clan or gens, to use the Latin term. And that family group was responsible for providing arms and armor rather than each warrior providing his own. This suggests that the greatest amount of central control in the military was at the level of the clan units. It's possible that the clan units, as well as city-states, had the autonomy to decide when and where to fight. The Greek historian Thucydides tells us that the Etruscans fought on the side of the Athenians against the Syracusans in the Sicilian expedition of 414 to 413 BC. But his terminology indicates that some of the Tyrrhenians were offering themselves as allies against Syracuse. This might mean city-states or units. It certainly doesn't mean the entire Etruscan people. Well, the only exception to this narrative is Orvieto, where in the 5th century BC, we see the rise of a new class of men who were not aristocratic or particularly wealthy, and might be seen as middle class, or as one author calls them, proto-hoplites. They participated in the defense of the city in a group that reflected an egalitarian ideology and which seems to have rejected the class distinctions found in other cities. The Roman historian Cassius Dio provides some support for this in his account of the elites at Orvieto losing control of the city to the men who served in the army. Now, the literary evidence for battle formation supports the non-hoplite conclusion, which I think is the accurate one for the remainder of Etruscan communities. For example, the Greek historian Dionysius of Halicarnassus recounted from the Battle of Cumae in 524 BC. When the barbarians, that is the Etruscans, learned that the Greeks were ready to fight, they uttered their war cry and came to close quarters in the barbarian fashion, without any order, the horse and the foot intermingled. Furthermore, the Roman historian Livy writes of a battle in 311 BC. The Etruscans had no reserves to support their first line, and all fell in front of their standards or around them. There's no evidence of the Etruscans ever creating a rank-and-file sort of organization, or one based on unit preparedness, as the Romans did. Rather, Livy's account states that the Etruscans all moved up to fight together, leaving no strategic reserve. What's more, he observes that the battle occurred because the Etruscans were eager to fight, and it continued until after sunset, very unusual in the ancient world, as the Etruscans refused to yield. The vast majority of them fought to the death. Neither of these decisions, to engage and to prolong the engagement, seem militarily prudent. Rather, individual Etruscans were seeking to demonstrate bravery and to gain personal loot. Such combat is a free-for-all. Some ancient sources state directly that the Etruscans did not fight in the same battle formations as the Romans, and that Etruscan aristocrats were in the front lines of battle. This is not the best place to put your commanders if you want them to survive the battle. Etruscans were capable of structured warfare. Their military camps were like their cities, orthogonally planned, that is, gridded out, and oriented on a north-south grid. It's just that the Etruscan social structure, combined with their equipment, checked effective organization on the battlefield. To give you another example of the interface between equipment and battle circumstances, Diodorus Siculus, a Greek author, declares that the Etruscans invented the war trumpet, or horn, to provide acoustic signals in battle, an invention later adopted unchanged by the Romans. To make it possible to hear these, the Etruscan helmet had uncovered ears and flexible cheek pieces, a very different design than Greek hoplite helmets. Well, we estimate that each city-state could muster 4,000 to 5,000 men-at-arms under their clan leaders. If they were unified, that should mean that the Etruscan League could mobilize up to 60,000 men. Annually, each city-state sent delegates to Fanum Voltumni to elect a common leader, the Vilath Mekel Rasnol, literally leader of the Etruscan people, who in theory would have led an Etruscan force against foreign armies. There's almost no evidence that ever occurred, and it appears that an Etruscan army consisting of various city-states never developed a unified hierarchical command structure. Despite that, they did come together in some instances. During the Samnite Wars, The Greek historians Polybius and Strabo put the total number of Etruscans who could be mobilized in 225 BC at 54,000. In comparison, the Romans at this time raised an annual army of 36,000 men. And the Ptolemies, the Greek rulers of Egypt in this period, had an army of 22,000, supplemented by 30,000 Egyptian auxiliaries, making it almost identical in size to the Etruscan force. Cities and individual units fought each other as well as foreign foes, sometimes on both sides of a conflict. Livy tells us that at one time the Etruscans controlled Italy from the Alps to the Strait of Sicily, but gradually lost all of this territory because of the military's cultural limitations. We can see the result of this in their alliances. And it's not just that they frequently picked the losing side. Sometimes they supported each side in turn. The 414 BC alliance with Athens against Syracuse made sense, following the Etruscan losses against the Greeks in 474 BC and 414 BC. But it didn't last. In 311 BC, the Etruscans sent 1,200 troops to fight in Sicily for the Carthaginian general Hamilcar against Agathocles of Syracuse. Only 4 years later, in 307 BC, they sent aid to Agathocles against the Carthaginians. The naval history of the Etruscans follows much the same pattern. Many ancient historians, including Diodorus, Dionysius, Strabo, and Livy, say that the Etruscans held dominion over the sea for a very long time. They were known as Thalassocratores, rulers of the seas. If they didn't control the entire Mediterranean, they certainly sailed its length and threatened other communities from west to east. They attempted to create a settlement in the Atlantic, offshore from the city of Cadiz, and were active at Huelva, the main port of Tartessos, on the southwestern coast of modern Spain. They attacked communities and shipping in the Balearic Islands, off Sardinia, Sicily, Corsica, and along the coasts of what are today Spain, France, and Italy. Between 485 and 475 BC, they occupied Lipari, just north of and in striking range of the Greek colonies on Sicily. Their threats to the Greek colonies were so severe that in 334 BC, Alexander the Great invited Rome to take action. Going east, the Etruscans raided the territory of Athens, abducting girls from the sanctuary of Artemis at Brauron, and further east, seizing the statue of Hera from the island sanctuary on Samos, just off the western coast of Turkey today. The Delians had to borrow 5,000 drachmas from the sacred treasury of Apollo on Delos in 299 BC to bolster defenses against Etruscan attack. The Etruscans were so formidable a threat that they made their way into Greek myth. They were responsible for kidnapping the Greek god Dionysus, a story that probably came about in the 7th century BC at Corinth, a major trading power in the Greek world at the time. Well, in addition to these raids and occasional attacks, they fought a series of major battles recorded in history. And tracing these gives us a sense of the larger combat trend in the Etruscan world. It goes from initial victories to inevitable crushing defeat after defeat. It starts in 535 BC at the Battle of Alalia, a naval battle off Corsica in which a Greek fleet was largely destroyed by a combined Etruscan and Phoenician, that is, Carthaginian force. The Etruscans occupied Corsica as a result. After that, the major battles all went against them. In 474 BC was the Battle of Cumae, a naval battle with the Greeks led by Hero of Syracuse and Aristodemus of Cumae. This Etruscan defeat led to the loss of their lands in southern Italy, essentially a third of their territory. In 453 BC, the Syracusans sailed north and struck against coastal areas in Tuscany and further north. In 415 BC, the Etruscans ally with Athens in the Sicilian expedition against Syracuse. Again, Etruscans were defeated along with the Athenians in the siege of 414-413, which included three Etruscan pentaconters, big ships. In 384 BC, Dionysius of Syracuse sailed north with 100 ships to sack the sanctuary at Pyrgi. And in 335 BC, Diotimos, an Athenian who served as military commander at Corcyra and at Naples, defeated the Etruscans in a naval battle off the west coast of Italy. Now, earlier in this lecture, I outlined the almost exclusively local command structure in the Etruscan military. The same structure applied to its naval forces, with the result that they also acted autonomously. We have a great deal of evidence for this, but I think a few examples will serve. The ships that aided Athens in the Sicilian expedition were commanded by Velther Spurinna of Tarquinia. It's notable that no higher authority is proclaimed for him than that of a Tarquinian. Similarly, and almost simultaneously, we have a record of Vel Cocna, commander of a pentaconter warship who served at the port city of Spina on the mouth of the Po River on the east coast of the Italian peninsula in the late 5th century BC. An image of him issuing commands on his ship was carved on his tombstone. He sits in the chair of an Etruscan magistrate and gestures with an outstretched arm as he commands his crew. This is a classic aristocratic display, and it's notable that ships were used, along with armor and chariots, as means to convey aristocratic status. Boat models were found in a number of tombs that served the same purpose as chariots and chariot models, in projecting an aristocratic identity for the deceased. The Sicilian expedition against Syracuse gives us key insight into additional reasons for the Etruscan naval losses that plagued them in the 5th century BC and later. They seem to have relied on the pentaconter. This is a warship rowed by 50 oarsmen. This was the major, or a major, ship of the line of the Archaic period, from 600 to 480 BC, used then by almost all navies, including the Greeks and the Persians. By the 5th century BC, however, the Greeks had almost all transitioned to the trireme. Rowed by 170 oarsmen, it was capable of bursts of higher speed with a lower center of gravity than the pentaconter, and it featured more deck space to facilitate boarding attacks. These factors made it superior in battle, as it was not only faster and more maneuverable, but the major attacks came from ramming or boarding. In both, ramming and boarding, the trireme was superior to the pentaconter. The Etruscan failure to innovate and adopt the superior Greek design, that is, superior ship design, seems to have doomed their navy to a succession of losses against the trireme navies of the Greeks. That's not to say that the Etruscans didn't innovate at all. They were responsible for one of the most successful and widely adopted naval inventions that increased the effectiveness of ships' offensive roles. This was the rostrum, the bronze ram attached to the underwater projecting bow of vessels, making the ramming technique much more powerful. Notably, as with military arms and armor, the development of the rostrum relied on the high-quality bronze manufacturing industry in Etruria. Indeed, these rams became ubiquitous as they were adopted by major naval forces across the ancient Mediterranean. and a number of them have turned up in underwater excavations of ancient shipwrecks. So what can we conclude about the Etruscan military? Well, we'll proceed from the premise that the way war is waged and the armies and navies that wage it are institutions that reflect the culture in which they're found. For the Etruscans, that means the deep stratification of society and its entrenched social organization by clan are responsible for the form of the army and how it was used. Aristocrats armed and fielded forces from their own resources and on their own authority. There seems to have been no political structure that served to require or deny aristocratic participation in any particular conflict. And there was certainly no greater authority than the city-state. Despite the lack of hierarchical command structure, the Etruscans were formidable foes. Dionysius states that on one occasion, the consuls were shaken by the size of the Etruscan army and the quality of its weapons. Having no great command structure, they also seem to have had no grand strategy. By the 5th century BC, the Greeks had fully adopted the phalanx, that is, a body of troops operating in close formation, with its benefits of mutual support, and they invented the trireme. The Etruscans improved their armor and ships, but never created the mechanisms to allow unified command and control, or advanced battlefield or naval maneuvers.